Chapter 16, The Fight on the Dunes. Action was always our key word. In the June of 1921, I staged a night raid on the British barracks situated at the strange old town of Glenties in Donegal. Creeping down on the barracks under cover of darkness, we announced our presence to the commander through the mouth of a machine gun. It was not our policy, however, in these surprise attacks, to kill indiscriminately. Our aim was to worry and harass the enemy until, in desperation, he quit. Several soldiers were foolish enough to dash out and return our fire. These were picked off by the riflemen as fast as the flashing of their guns marked the respective positions. An hour of heavy fire, and we again retreated to our haven in the hills. 2 days after the barracks attack, I raided a Belfast bank in Ardara. Taking 5 men with me, I waited under cover until the black and tans, thundering through the town in armoured cars and exhibiting a load of bristling bayonets as a threat against the inhabitants, made their round of the village. No sooner had the lorries swept out of sight in a vortex of dust than we came out of our cranny and sauntered into the bank. While I held up the manager, my aide-de-camp covered the cashier, cramming what we needed into our bag, and with due apologies for our crude method of crimping their standing in the community, we left, but not before I had explained the policy of the Republican war leaders to a raging manager. Whenever I planned a raid, I planned also a method of retreat in case of attack. Planting the loot for further reference, we retired towards our dugouts not far from the village of Ardara. On our way, I noticed a couple of little boats on the strand opposite the peninsula of Loch Nahara, a narrow strip of land some 10 miles long and half a mile wide. We could row across Lochras Bay and prevent pursuit. To reach this rugged finger of rocky land by road would take 30 miles of rough going. However, the inhabitants of Loch Nahara would shelter us against pursuers. These rugged mountaineers made their own poteen and lived beyond the pale of a law. It was an excellent rendezvous for brigands, and we aimed to go there if the black and tans hit on the trail. We were near our base, not far from Rossbeg, when, suddenly, 20 black tunics showed above a ditch. Simultaneously, there followed a burst of rifle fire, the bullets whistling all about us. If any of the tans had possessed better aim, our little party of 6 would have been exterminated in one blast. But they missed and continued to blaze as we scattered. "Down!" I yelled, and gave orders as I squirmed along on my belly. "Callan, come with me. You other fellows split and make for the rocks and the sand dunes." Callan and I backed up through the heather towards a long sandy beach, firing often enough to halt the progress of the tans. The enemy, recognizing my dark woolen sweater and green collar as that of the commander, concentrated their pursuit on Callan and me, permitting the rest of the party to make a getaway. Then began a long-running duel. If the tans had a fair marksman among them, the chase would have ended swiftly. But the bullets sang by as we alternately ran and dropped to make an elusive target. For a mile or more they chased us, their aim gradually improving. 2 bullets tore through my sweater, 1 grazed my side. The running scrap was reminiscent of bush fighting in East Africa, except that we had neither bush nor twig to help us. In the distance, however, from where we had come, stretched sand dunes, their mounds offering the protection of trenches. Once behind these ridges, the enemy would have a tough job to catch us. We had almost reached our objective when a bullet caught me in the hip. An inch higher and it would have gone clean through my left lung. Nevertheless, the pain crippled me. My aide-de-camp helped me until we reached the dunes, where I found temporary cover from the tans' fire. "Ginger," I said, "take these papers and get back to headquarters." They were communications of value to the enemy, and I was determined that if they took me, it would be empty-handed, save for my carbine. "Beat it as fast as you can, Callan," I persisted. "Tell Martin to take command until further orders." Huey Martin was a splendid leader and would carry on. Besides, we knew someone had tipped off the Tans and that informer must pay for the ambush. My position was becoming desperate. I was almost surrounded by the pursuers. I scared off several with my carbine, but the high-powered bullets of the enemy were ploughing through the sand, keeping me low. The foe advanced with caution after I had registered a few minor hits. But just as I lifted up to fire again, a bullet crossed at another angle and tore across the surface of my hand, putting me completely out of action. The 2-mile run along the beach, coupled with the wounds I had sustained, took their toll. All I could do now was to wait until the British came up to make their capture. The last bullet had ripped the flesh wide open, numbing the entire hand. "Come out of there, you big Irish!" The word big is always a compliment to me, for though I am broad of beam, I am rather short in stature. I could scarcely move, but my captors poked their gun muzzles down at me, demanding that I put up my hands. I crawled out of the sandpit, bleeding like a stuck pig. "Let's shoot the Sinn Féiner," snarled one fellow, levelling his rifle. Another decided to use his fists and made a pass which I ducked. I dropped my hands, prepared to land out of the bully even at the cost of my life. Then a Britisher, with some decency, intervened. "Can't you see the blighter's badly hurt?" I was mighty glad that my captors were composed of British and Royal Irish constabulary. I knew I could expect some measure of justice and understanding from the former, even though I realized the vindictiveness of my own race when holding the whip hand. "Where did the other fellow go?" asked the leader of the group, glancing towards the low pile of sand. I lied gracefully. "He's up there in the dunes with a wound in his leg, but he's a crack shot and it'll cost you a couple of men to get him." They looked at each other, and several reconnoitred in a faint-hearted fashion, expecting momentarily to draw a spurt of flame. After a few minutes, however, they abandoned the search and returned. They had captured the leader, and that pleased their vanity. It was a painful journey back to our dugout, to which they led me. Loss of blood made me dizzy, but I managed to survive the 2-mile jaunt without a tumble. Gnats and flies clustered on my wounded hand, and I was offered no medical attention. Armoured cars pulled up at the dugout, and the Tans made me walk in front of them into the entrance. I was certain that our quarters were deserted, but they would not trust me. A dozen Mills bombs were hurled into the cave and trench and sent clouds of clay and earth skyward. The enemy now marched me into a cottage where I was subjected to a military third degree, but not a word did they get out of me. I was then charged with the murder of 6 men and sundry other crimes. There followed a general round-up in the neighbourhood, and many non-combatants were jammed into the armoured cars. We were then driven to Glenty's barracks in the village of that name, a distance of 7 or 8 miles. When the lorry came to a stop in the village street, women and children surged around it. One spirited old lady recognised me and piped up to the officer in charge, "You won't hold that fellow long!" That night, an itinerant quack from the village washed and bandaged my wounds. They should have been stitched, but I do not believe the old medico possessed either suturing equipment or was capable of performing the task. After 3 days in Glenty's, my only bed the stone floor of the old jail, I was delighted to get a change of residence. Donegal Barracks was the next stop, and here I learned, via Sinn Féin intelligence, the name of the informer who tipped off the Tans. Our network reached into every enemy barrack, even into Dublin Castle itself. I dispatched the information to my adjutant, Hughie Martin, now in command of the column, instructing him to capture the informer, give him a fair trial, and, if guilty, to shoot him. There is an interesting phase to the trial and execution of a certain Mr. Kelly. He came from an Irish Catholic family and was the only yellowback in the crowd. A curious sort of misanthropy was with a grudge against the world. He was an avowed atheist, a rare specimen in an Irish village where Christianity, Catholic or Protestant, is such a vehement force. The informer made his home with a distinguished local doctor. I do not believe that the medico had any knowledge of Kelly's perfidy. Hughie Martin tracked him down and, paying a visit to the house, was greeted by a very comely Colleen, Kelly's niece. Her lack of sympathy with her uncle's predicament was certainly made up for by her enthusiasm for the gallant brigand about to execute him. Dashing into the house with guns drawn, Huey and his men seize the culprit. Dragging him from the house to the outskirts of the town for the execution, Kelly begged for a priest, though he was an acknowledged atheist. Huey chased back one of his grumbling men for a priest, and they sat down to wait for his arrival. Suddenly, the dejected figure of Kelly sprang into action, and he popped over the hedge, down a steep slope, and into the valley. The guards were nimble as mountain goats, however, and they brought him back before he got very far. He was shot forthwith, without benefit of clergy, and a label was tagged over him as a warning. It read, "Executed by the Irish Republican Army for giving information to the enemy. Signed, Commandant 3rd Brigade, 1st Northern Division." In the morning, the body was gone. After my subsequent escape from Ebrington Barracks, I found a refuge with a family who operated the post office in a remote village in Donegal, and I learned, by coincidence, that Kelly's mother had resided there for the summer. She received a letter from an English watering place that aroused my immediate suspicion. Huey Martin reported the execution and the puzzling disappearance of the body. I suspected I had the answer in my hands. Steaming the letter open, I read with amazement Kelly's own version of the so-called execution and the vanishing of the corpse. He explained to his mother how a steel vest had saved him from the Sinn Féin assassins. He was recuperating in an English sanatorium. Months later, Kelly wrote me from England asking permission to return home. His letter was the humble petition of a repentant sinner. He was willing to stand trial and to make reparation for his traitorous act. I never answered the letter. Civil war was looming, and we had plenty of internal dissension to claim our attention. Also, I had no personal desire for revenge. After I left Ireland again, he came home and may still be living, for all I know, of his career since 1921. Hugh Martin later became a captain in the regular Free State Army. After 2 years of enlistment, he went to Australia. In 1933, he received a severe sentence of penal servitude in Sydney, Australia, for organized banditry and attempted murder. That may be true, but Huey was a gallant Republican soldier when I knew him, and a most loyal comrade.